in case you're wondering, it's 301 shopping days till Christmas. Yeah, Christmas has come and gone, so now's probably a very good time for me to make a confession. I really, really hate nativity plays. Can't stand them. It's been suggested to me that if there ever comes a point in time where I'm watching my own children in a nativity play, I would change my mind. And that may well be true, but even if it is, it doesn't change my main point, which is that a nativity play is a story for children. And the problem is that we live in a culture that's never moved beyond that, and we think that that's what Christmas is all about. It's a very cute little story, you know, the classic, the innkeeper who manages to say very quickly, we've got no room, but I do have a stable round the back. And the cutest girl they can find in the school with blonde ringlets, dressed in white and wearing wings made out of coat hangers, who's anything but scary, saying to Mary, don't be afraid. The problem with that story is it has no relevance to your life and no relevance to my life. Now, there are several people here today who I know have been present at childbirth. I've seen a few. Obviously, I haven't done it myself, but I've seen a few. And it's messy, and it's difficult, and it's horrible. And I have no doubt that Jesus' birth was just the same. And I have no doubt that when the gospel writers talked about Jesus' birth, they weren't trying to paint this romantic, perfect picture. Because the whole point is that God's Son became man and lived a real life in the real world, facing the same struggles that we do. And because that is true, it's relevant to your life and it's relevant to mine. So we're going to look at God's faithfulness, focusing on these verses of Luke that follow on from the very famous Christmas verses. There are two ways to approach Luke's gospel, simplistically, as it says there. One is as an historical document, and it is. It's a historical document without really any comparison. The New Testament, in terms of ancient literature, stands unchallenged. The sheer weight of documentary evidence is massive. And Luke is a very careful historian. And over the centuries, many parts of his writings in both Luke's and Acts have been challenged. And as more evidence comes to the fore, we find that Luke is wrong and the critic, sorry, Luke is right. Get in trouble now. Luke is right and the critics are wrong. But the other thing is that because it's true and because it describes the events of Jesus' life, it's also a spiritual document. And so it's both. But it's not a biography. As a biographer, each of the gospel writers would be in serious trouble. You know, only two of them actually mention anything before he was age 30. And Luke tells us a little bit about Jesus' birth, doesn't tell us anything for 12 years, and then has a 20-year gap before picking up the story. But it's not meant to be a biography. Luke is telling us about this man Jesus, all that he said and did. So why does Luke include this story? Well, the first answer is because it's true. Luke was a very thorough historian. You can see from the first chapter when he describes why he's writing the gospel, he's researched everything very carefully. He's talked to several sources, and I don't think there's any doubt that one of his sources was Mary. Some of the things he includes he could only get from Mary. And also because this is a spiritual document, it can teach us something. So let's look at what it can teach us in 2006. Just to go over slightly the wider picture, to paint the scene for you slightly. Both Luke and Matthew place the birth of Jesus within the reign of Herod the Great. That helps us time-wise because we know that he died in about 4 BC. Roughly. And then the most famous verse of Luke probably is the census verse, which causes some problems from a historical point of view, because we know that Quirinius was governor of Syria in about 6 AD, which kind of doesn't fit. And this is one of the many examples in which Luke has been incredibly attacked. But later sources have shown that Luke was right. Quirinius was governor more than once. And so we can place these events somewhere between 7 and 5 BC is when Jesus was born. It's interesting that you often hear accusations that the Bible is unreliable, and Muslims will tell you that Christians have changed the Bible to make it say what we want it to. If that were true, then verses like Luke 2:2 wouldn't exist, because until 150 years ago, everyone thought Luke had got it wrong. So for some period of time, probably about 1500 years, it was thought that Luke had made a mistake. And so if we were desperate to correct our scriptures, we would have changed that verse. But it's still there, and Luke was proven to be right. As you may have noticed, Luke doesn't mention the visit of the Magi. I think probably it fits in around verse 39 and a half in terms of Luke's story. So between the point where Jesus is presented at the temple, up until the, and then Luke describes them going back to Nazareth. So sometime in the middle there, is a time when the Magi visit. Why Luke doesn't mention that is an open question, and I've read lots of speculation, but nothing convincing. And so probably it's quite logical to assume that Mary and Joseph are temporarily living in Bethlehem. It's quite a long way from Nazareth to Bethlehem. Nazareth is right up the top there, and Bethlehem is about 4 or 5 miles from Jerusalem. It would have taken many days' journey. Now, with a newly born baby, many days' journey when you don't know where you're going to stay in a hostile land doesn't really appeal. Joseph had family in Bethlehem. That's implicitly clear. So it seems very likely they would have set up a home there temporarily. Joseph's carpentry work would have been valuable anywhere. But to make the short journey to Jerusalem for religious reasons is doable. It's only 4 or 5 miles. It's a day trip when you're walking there and back. And so we read in Luke's gospel of how they did it. First of all, we read that on the 8th day he was circumcised and named Jesus, as the angel said he should be. And then in verses 22 to 3, Luke says this: when the time of their purification according to the law of Moses had been completed, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. The time of purification, and the other thing that he goes on to say is, as it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or 2 young pigeons. So Exodus 13 is where your footnote will refer you about the firstborn male. This is after the Passover. God says, your firstborn male must be special to me, because this is a gift that I've given you, and I want you to remember that it's me that's giving it to you. It's a little reminder for the people that God's more important. And Leviticus 12 gives the details of a woman being ceremonially unclean after childbirth. Now, we could spend the next 3 hours arguing about why that is so, and I don't intend to do so. It's a difficult passage. I don't think it's particularly pertinent to the point Luke's trying to make. Luke is simply saying that all of the religious rituals were performed perfectly for Jesus. No one can doubt his authentic Jewishness. The one little point that you also get from here is it talks about that a pair of doves or 2 young pigeons were offered. The reason for this is that in Leviticus 12 it says a lamb should be offered, and it says if the family is poor and can't afford a lamb, 2 pigeons or 2 doves will suffice. So we're reminded here by Luke that Jesus was born into a poor family. I don't think there's any doubt that Jesus knew what it was to be at the bottom of the human pile. So they go to the temple in Jerusalem to offer the sacrifices to fulfill the law, and they meet some strange people there. The first one is Simeon, who we read about in verses 25 to 35. Now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon, who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Christ. Moved by the Spirit, he went into the temple courts when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him what the custom of the law required. Simeon took him in his arms and praised God. So what do we know about Simeon? He is righteous and devout. Unlike some of the hypocritical religious leaders, Simeon was serious about his faith, serious about righteousness. Awaiting the consolation of Israel. What a great phrase that is. God had promised all through the Old Testament that he would rescue his special people. And it had been a very long time since they had heard any prophecies in Israel. And yet Simeon, because he was devout, because he was faithful, was waiting for God to fulfill that promise. And Luke also tells us the Holy Spirit was upon him in some special way. And through that, the Holy Spirit had promised Simeon that he would see the Lord's Christ. And so when he sees Jesus, he praises God, saying, "Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you now dismiss your servant in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the sight of all people, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to your people Israel." And then Simeon prophesies, which I really can't spell, nor can Microsoft either. It's interesting the words that he uses. "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that we've spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and the words to Mary, and a sword will pierce your own soul too." And then in verses 26 to 38, we hear about Anna, who we hear is a prophetess and a widow, and that she spends all her time in the temple. It might mean literally she had a room within the huge temple complex to sleep, or it might mean she spent her waking hours there. But again, she prophesies over Jesus. But Luke doesn't offer us any details on this occasion. So as I always encourage our teenagers to say, so what? What does that mean to us? What is Luke and through him God trying to tell us? Well, the first very obvious point is that this is a very special child. Luke is emphasizing that from the very beginning there was no doubt that there's something very special about Jesus. He tells his readers that perfect attention to Jewish law was followed. And then both Anna and Simeon give prophecy about Jesus and what he will do, which later we see is fulfilled. And Luke is teaching us about God's faithfulness. In essence, the first point is the same as the second, because Jesus is the best example of God's faithfulness. In fact, literally the embodiment of God's faithfulness. And that's true both generally and specifically. And so, generally, we're talking about God's plan for salvation, which begins in Genesis 3, in case you haven't noticed. From the very beginning, God was planning to save us. God knew we'd need saving. And all the way through the Old Testament, this is what God is at work doing. God promises all through the prophets to send a Messiah. And then we have 400 years of silence. This is the time in which Simeon and Anna were living. God hadn't spoken. The Greeks had come and gone. The Romans were running the empire. They were living under oppression. They were still God's chosen people. I suspect that so many were disillusioned at this point. But we know at least one man wasn't. We know that Simeon was waiting for the consolation of Israel. He knew that God was serious when he promised to send his Christ. And specifically, God also made a promise to Simeon that Simeon himself, before he died, would get to see the Christ. And so that's what Simeon was waiting for. I think all of us know what it's like to wait on God and how difficult it can be. Simeon was an old man. He'd been waiting his entire lifetime for this. But he was still waiting, still expecting God to do what he said. It also tells us something about God's concern for individuals. For whatever reason, God chose Simeon to be used in this way, to be part of this little story we have here, which re-emphasizes a point that comes up in several places in the Bible, but I think is vital to all of us. That God is passionately concerned about individuals. As I said, Simeon was an old man. You see the parallel between the promises to Israel and them waiting 400 years, and Simeon, who had been waiting a whole lifetime. But Simeon was waiting on God and was expecting God to do what he said. You will hear people say things like this, talk about blind faith and how that's what a Christian needs. This is something else I hate. I want to make it clear that biblical faith, even screens are different. Biblical faith is never blind faith. It's never what God asked of us. You may have noticed that you have a brain. God made it. God gave it to you. God doesn't expect you to switch it off and stop using it. All the things that God has given you are to be used for his glory. God asks for a rational faith. And to paraphrase slightly, which is always a dangerous thing to do, God says, on the basis of what I've already done, trust me when I say what I will do. And for Simeon, he knew all the stories of what God had done for his people. And so when he looked at the promises of a Messiah, and when God specifically promised him that he would see it, he was expectantly waiting for God to fulfill that promise, because he knows, he knew all that God had already done. And surely that should be easier for us, because in Jesus we've seen the fulfillment of all that God has promised. So we know that God will keep the promises that he's left us with, even in difficult days. So I want to just take a few moments to look at some of God's promises. There are so many to choose from, but these are a few that I thought were quite good. This one particularly. He who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. I think it's very easy when life gets tough to wonder where everything's gone wrong, to feel like there's no hope left. But as Paul is reminding the Philippians, the one who began in you this good work of salvation isn't going to give up and leave it half done. By sending Jesus, that was the difficult bit, that was the expensive bit. Finishing off the work of salvation in your life is by comparison very easy for God. He's not going to leave it unfinished. Don't think I need to say any more. I wonder how many of us can remember past times when this has been true, when we just can't go on, and then we've known the Lord's strengthening. I wasn't going to mention this, but it's just occurred to me, my brother's here. I'm sure he remembers as vividly as I do the day Mum died, and we had a lot of driving around and sorting things out, and it was all very hectic and very difficult. And there were lots of people that we knew were praying for us. And I remember very vividly at one point during that journey when we both said we felt so different, so able to carry on. Maybe a coincidence, but I find the more I pray, the more I see coincidences. The second half of the Great Commission, which tells us something we should do, and with it this fantastic promise, I am with you to the very end of the age. What an amazing promise. Not only will he keep you strong, but you will be blameless when you stand before the holy, sovereign God, blameless and unashamed. What an amazing promise. And one of my personal favourites. And God was very serious about this promise, because he said it twice. It's in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. I think God was particularly trying to make the point. Never, never, never will I leave you. And never will I give up on you. You may have noticed it's on the other screen. Doubt. No, I don't think I can. I have on my screen a really good countdown that tells me how long it is to go till the new year. But sadly not on your screen. I blame Paul for this. Spent 10 minutes writing that. Anyway, get back to the point. It's 12 hours, 34 minutes and 8 seconds till the new year. The truth is, we live uncertain lives. Something that occurred to me quite strongly recently is how there's a very strong, very powerful lie that affects our culture and certainly affects us as well. And it's the modern Western lie that we are in control of our lives. Because we have historically unprecedented security, we've been at peace for 60 years. We know financial security to a greater or lesser extent. But even if it all goes wrong, we know where our next meal is coming from because we have a society that protects us, and that's a great thing. We should never give up that. And because we have a first-class healthcare system, anyone who says otherwise has to argue with me later, because we have a first-class health system, because we live very healthy lives generally, we think we're in control. We feel safe and secure. And the problem with that lie is how damaging it is when we discover it's not true. You see, if you lived in parts of the third world, if you lived 150 years ago, you would have known that your life was precarious, and it wouldn't have been a shock when you discovered that it was. But because we live with this illusion that we're in control, it's so much more difficult to cope with when we discover that we're not. I know some of the things that some of you have experienced in the past year. I know some of the things that I've been through. Well, probably know all the things that I've been through. And a couple of stories occurred to me, which won't surprise you with professional ones. Just over a year ago, I had to talk to a patient who was in her 40s and explain to her that she had cancer and explain to her that it might be treatable, but it probably wouldn't be curable. Walking her through that is an interesting thing to do. It's something that's actually quite easy to do well, but also incredibly difficult to do well. You see, to do it well, one simply has to open one's heart and be prepared to feel and offer God-like love and sympathy, true empathy. But you see, she'd gone from a certain amount of uncertainty because she didn't know why she was ill to knowing that she probably wouldn't be alive in 2 years' time. We have no control. Most of us have fairly well-paid jobs, but we enjoy relative job security, but we don't actually know what's going to happen next. This is the real world that we live in, and this is also the world that Jesus was born into. And you see, this is the point. As we go into 2007, it would be traditional at this point for me to wish you all a happy new year, but I've decided that's actually fairly pointless. Wishes don't change anything. And yes, I would like you all to have a very happy new year. I suspect, given that there's more than two people here, the odds are that you won't. Some of you are going to have very difficult years. And so we come back to this point of what's really important. With all of these, God's promises. The story of Simeon and Anna is a very simple way of remembering that God keeps his promises. Whatever God has promised, and here are some good examples, he will do. In the person of Jesus, God kept his greatest promises to offer salvation. And he's not